The story of Mozart mesmerized me. I listened to each chapter in a state of total absorption. I thought the idea of a young boy composing music not only was enchanting, but was worthy of emulating. I went home one afternoon and took a pad of blank notebook paper, a ruler, and a pencil out onto the hill behind our house. I drew a staff and started to write notes. It only took a minute to realize that what Mozart had done was far more complicated and evolved than what I could do.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, we'll hear from author and composer John Adams. Adams has won the Pulitzer Prize for his work, and he's the composer of many well-known contemporary operas, including Nixon in China and Dr. Atomic. In his new book, Hallelujah Junction, Adams describes his journey as an artist and a person. He's a thoughtful man who reflects on topics like art and history, deeply yet wonderfully accessibly. The same could be said of his compositions. They're erudite, philosophical, but spun through with a play and polish of popular culture. Adams writes about how he came to embrace the avant-garde and how he came to challenge it. This reading of Hallelujah Junction was recorded in November 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for coming. There's no place in the world I would rather be than a bookstore. You know, in that movie Raising Arizona, you know, where the Nicolas Cage character, who's a, you know, recidivist, keeps going back. Every time he drives by a 7-Eleven, he gets the urge. He just has to go in and hold it up. And, you know, I'm that way with a bookstore. I just absolutely have to go buy another book that I'm not going to finish. And so now I've added to the detritus by writing my own. Hallelujah Junction, by the way, is actually a location. It's a little tiny crossroads in the Sierras. And when I first drove by it, I said to myself, that's a great title, looking for a piece. So I actually wrote a piece. It's a piece for two pianos called Hallelujah Junction. And when I finished this book, I had a big go-around with my editor, Jonathan Galassi, at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and he didn't like any of my titles. It was the only difficult experience I had in the whole process of creating the book was finding a title that he felt was a good one. And in frustration one day, I just handed him a list of all my compositions, and he said, oh, there it is, right there. And I'm glad he chose it, because I think it's a memorable phrase that sticks in the head. My goal in writing this book was threefold, maybe fourfold. The first was to write a book that future generation of composers, particularly composers, but also young creative people could read, to just follow one person's personal Bildungsroman, personal history of how I became a composer and the doubts that I had. And I tried to be very candid in the book. And although I, you know, occasionally have some critical things to say about composers that mean a great deal to me, like Charles Ives, for example, the composer I'm most critical of in this book is myself. And I try to, in some instances, somewhat clear some confusions or assumptions that people have about the creative process. For example, I think most people assume that if you're a composer, you're a genius. You know, part of the job description. And, yeah, it's possible, but generally we're people who like to play with sounds. And I talk a bit in the book about the creative process. It, you know, at least what I've experienced and what I know of other composers, what I've read, you know, about Beethoven, what I know about my colleagues, and the fact that we compose because we like to make noise and we like to bang on something, whether it's a piano or a percussion instrument or, you know, a synthesizer or whatever, and put those noises together in new shapes and new forms. We don't walk around hearing in our inner ear every detail of a fully orchestrated orchestra piece as if we had a personal iPod. And I think most people do think that. You know, people come up to me and say, I don't know how you can keep that all in your head. And the answer is I can't. You know, we have sort of generalized shapes, and we can, you know, imagine sort of vague musical images. But I doubt even Mozart, you know, heard the G minor symphony with the absolute clarity that we attribute it to him. Another purpose of writing the book was just the sheer pleasure of writing a memoir. And I love firsthand accounts, you know, whether it's St. Augustine talking about his trials and tribulations with the flesh, or Henry Adams, my namesake, but no relation, which is really a wonderful book, which I recently reread. But the actual book that spurred this was the memoirs of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which, if you haven't read, are just phenomenal. What I loved about it was his candor, his humor, his self-deprecation, his humility, and of course the wonderful people that, you know, populate his life. So that was something. So I didn't think I possessed all those qualities, but I knew that I had an interesting story to tell. And last but not least, I wanted to give a personal record of some of my own pieces, mostly my stage work. So there's chapters later on in the book, there are individual chapters devoted to my major stage works: Nixon in China, The Death of Klinghoffer, which is an opera I wrote in 1991 about terrorism and an actual event, the hijacking of the Achille Lauro and the murder of Leon Klinghoffer; On the Transmigration of Souls, which is not an opera, but it's a choral and orchestra piece that I wrote to commemorate 9/11 for the New York Philharmonic; Dr. Atomic, there's a whole chapter on that called A Swirl of Atoms, ATOMS, and my most recent opera, A Flowering Tree, which was premiered in Vienna with a orchestra and chorus from Venezuela. And there's even a person in the audience here who sang in that premiere. So I thought I'd read a little bit about my childhood first. I grew up in New Hampshire. Both my parents were amateur musicians. My mother had never studied, never had a chance to take any music lessons. She did everything by ear, but she was a phenomenal talent. My father was less naturally talented, but he had a very logical mind, and he was my first teacher. He taught me the clarinet. You have to imagine, this is a very, very rural community in outside of Concord, New Hampshire, where most of my friends went deer hunting while I was home practicing the clarinet. In 1956, when I was 9 years old, our third grade teacher read aloud a child's biography of Mozart. This teacher, a delicate and cultivated woman in her 50s with the graceful name of Greta Swanson, loved classical music. She brought in recordings of Gaiseking and Casals, and I suspect I was the only student who showed interest and appreciation and could share her passion. The story of Mozart mesmerized me. I listened to each chapter in a state of total absorption. I thought the idea of a young boy composing music not only was enchanting, but was worthy of emulating. I went home one afternoon and took a pad of blank notebook paper, a ruler, and a pencil out onto the hill behind our house. I drew a staff and started to write notes. It only took a minute to realize that what Mozart had done was far more complicated and evolved than what I could do. I was bitterly let down and didn't confess my disappointment to parents for a long time. But eventually they located a teacher of theory at St. Paul's School, a wealthy prep school on the outskirts of the city, and I began a more or less orderly course in composition, harmony, theory, and went on in fits and starts for about 4 years. A Magnavox cabinet version high fidelity 33 RPM record player had been our family's Christmas present to itself in December of 1957. No other event in my childhood changed my life as abruptly as the arrival of this piece of audio equipment. Although I was already well advanced in my clarinet playing, even by the age of 10, the sudden availability of recorded music crowded out almost every other activity for most of the following 2 years. The old turntable and radio affair from Vermont that my father had jerry-rigged together had been lost in the move to New Hampshire. In the intervening period, my parents had simply never had the time or the money to buy a new record player. But now the new Magnavox in the front living room quickly became grand central for my every uncommitted moment. We didn't own a piano, so my musical experience up to then was from my clarinet, and it was largely melody-driven. Once we acquired the Magnavox, a new LP recording appeared in the house on a weekly basis, many bought at my insistent pleading. Brandenburg concertos, Beethoven symphonies, Mozart string quartets, Rhapsody in Blue, and big band recordings by my parents' favorites, Benny Goodman and Duke Ellington. I had several recordings of the serene and perfect late clarinet music of Mozart, both the concerto and the A major quintet. I soon began learning both these pieces, and I eventually performed them with local orchestras and chamber groups. I preferred listening to music while lying on the floor, directly in front of the speaker, head in hands, or if no one was around, I would continue with my fantasies of being a conductor, learning much of the standard orchestral repertoire this way, by ear, without scores, purely by listening over and over and conducting the music. At that age, the experience was akin to language acquisition. So naturally and so automatically did I absorb pieces by listening and moving my arms, giving cues and raising crescendos. Many years later, when my own son and daughter were taking their first music lessons, I read a book called Nurtured by Love by the Japanese pedagogue Shinichi Suzuki. You've probably all heard of the Suzuki method, for good or bad. Suzuki's success in teaching very young children rested on his belief that musical skill can be acquired by everyone, regardless of supposed talent. If music is treated in the same way that language is, as a natural, almost unconsciously acquired skill, then it might be gained with similar ease. Suzuki reasoned that since virtually every human in the world speaks his or her own language fluently, there's no reason that he or she cannot play an instrument with equal fluency, given the proper environment. I find this premise believable, and although I could never quite become an unqualified fan of Suzuki's detailed curriculum, I think that the way that I acquired music as a child very much bears out his central thesis. My ability with the clarinet brought both pleasure and pain. I learned it almost too quickly, and I rapidly outgrew whatever musical programs the local public schools had to offer. School bands and orchestras were simply too slow and not challenging enough for me, and I became bratty and impatient when made to sit through a slow rehearsal. This offended the music teachers and placed my parents in the delicate position of having to appease the teachers while not forcing me to waste long hours in rudimentary situations. Fortunately, I was invited to join two adult ensembles at a very young age, one an orchestra and the other a concert band. These groups became my laboratories as both performers and a composer. Without them, I would never have advanced as quickly as I did. The orchestra, the adult orchestra that I played in, and I was the only youngster to be in it, performed under the august name of the New Hampshire State Hospital Auxiliary Orchestra. It was a community ensemble sponsored by the Maine Mental Hospital in the state. The performers were local amateurs, businessmen, school teachers, a car mechanic, our family doctor on trombone, several lawyers, and others who enjoyed a weekly confrontation with their instruments that they had learned in their youth. The repertoire was light classics. The first rehearsal I ever played included the Schubert Unfinished Symphony, Peer Gynt Suite by Grieg, but we also played show tunes and Sousa marches. Occasionally, a patient would be allowed to join the orchestra with predictably unpredictable results. Concerts were given three or four times a season for the assembled patients. These concerts were intense affairs. Nurses and guards would lead hundreds of patients in single file into the gymnasium where we in the orchestra sat, ready to play our concert. The first thing that I would notice would be the dank, suffocating odor of unwashed clothes and perspiring bodies. A constant, low-level din of talk and chaotic movement prevailed throughout the show. Patients shouted and waved. When I, the only young person in the orchestra, walked onto the stage, the audience would inevitably break out into loud, wildly approving applause, and my face would go crimson with embarrassment. Intermissions were accompanied by punch and cookies, and the orchestra members were encouraged to mingle with the patients. A scarecrow of a woman in a long, faded taffeta dress would never fail to seek me out and clasp me to her bony bosom. Half of her nose was missing, sliced off in some awful event of her past. I found it impossible to extricate myself from her desperate grip until the attendants came and gently untangled us. Another patient walked around with a harmonica stuffed in his mouth. When he smiled, his face became the front grille of an automobile. He serenaded us by moving the harmonica with his lips while conducting with his free hands. My fame among the patients peaked in my 15th year when I composed a suite for string orchestra with the help of my composition teacher. He conducted the premiere while I stood anxiously behind the audience, wincing at every wrong note or false entrance, of which there were many. When the conductor summoned me for a bow, the audience of patients, by then already diehard Adams fans, went berserk. So then I moved on to my college years, and the second chapter is called From Help to Let It Be. And these are the two Beatles albums that framed the 7 years that I was at Harvard University. First as an undergraduate, and then as a 2 years as a graduate student. I went to see the movie Help, which was a sort of early madcap Beatles movie. On the first night that I got to Cambridge with my roommates, and as I was leaving 7 years later, in the stores was the album Let It Be, which was their what I call here their terminal anthem of resignation and valediction. Which was in the stores. So I was in college during the turbulent 60s, and the second chapter is a description in part of, being on campus, particularly being on the campus of Harvard University during the anti-war riots, and my confrontation with rock and electronic music. In the pre-digital era. I read you just a couple of short sections. One day I was going back from Cambridge, back to my hometown in New Hampshire. While I was driving north from Cambridge to Live Free or Die, New Hampshire, that was the motto on their license plate, in late 1968, a beefy-looking man in a Ford Galaxy overtook me in the passing lane. He made a quick evaluation, and for no other reason than pure animosity, showed me the middle finger. My John Lennon granny glasses and my mustache, sideburns, and long hair, not to mention the Volkswagen I was driving, were enough for him to define me as being on the other side. The person attached to that finger was only one of many who saw in the younger generation an insult and a threat to their way of life, to democracy, freedom, and the American way. 2 years later, feelings had degenerated even more. Standing alone on the side of Massachusetts Avenue, watching a large anti-war march go by, I suddenly found myself part of a panicking crowd being attacked by club-swinging Boston police in riot gear. The helmeted cop who lunged at me with a billy club seemed genuinely delighted to have been given carte blanche to thrash away at a member of the college-educated elite. Sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like just 2 weeks ago. It was as if American society had been left on spin cycle, with no one capable of calming the nation's anxieties. In the phrase of William Burroughs, we'd bought the ticket that exploded. Back in the dorm room and at all-night parties of pot, scotch, whiskey, and unfiltered lucky strikes, we bored like weevils through the harmonic changes and textual minutiae of albums by the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, Bob Dylan, Cream, Jefferson Airplane, The Electric Flag. Anybody remember that band? The Electric Flag. Country Joe and the Fish, the Beach Boys, the Doors, and, of course, Jimi Hendrix. I would fall asleep on the hardwood floor of a friend's room with my head wedged between a pair of stereo speakers as if they were headphones, and I would wake up in sweaty clothes, smelling gamey, my glasses bent out of shape, and find that I was already late for class. I made more progress in my command of harmonic practice by reproducing these pop songs from memory at the piano than I ever did by my forced marches through the figured bass treaties and dry harmony textbooks. More than any other social phenomenon of a socially phenomenal era, rock music was the fulcrum of a culture. Young people communicated to each other through the medium of its lyrics, especially the lyrics by Bob Dylan and John Lennon. And its intense emotionalism seemed to speak for our common experience and what we imagine to be our universally held beliefs. What particularly enchanted me about the popular music of the time was its harmonic ingenuity, something that was fresh and inventive in the late 60s, although it would soon become routine and predictable within a short span of 5 or 10 years. A song like Brian Wilson's Good Vibrations took the standard pop song through a tonal hall of mirrors, moving into remote keys with an effortlessness that gave the music its feeling of endless delight. Wouldn't It Be Nice, another Beach Boys song by Brian Wilson, begins with an 8-bar introduction in A major played on the harp, which is then followed after a single thwop on the drum by the main tune in the remote flat submediant key of F. This kind of tonal surprise was nothing new in the classical or jazz world, but appearing here in the context of a standard rock and roll song, it felt novel and fresh. More than any other songwriter of that era, Brian Wilson understood the value of harmonic surprise. The Beatles, too, even from their earliest days, demonstrated an exceptional harmonic imagination. And as their message matured, their vision became increasingly complex and shaded, their harmonic world ever richer. Songs on what we knew as the White Album or on Abbey Road went deeper in every sense, emotionally, psychologically, harmonically, textually, and in the incredible wit and invention of their sound world. The LP album went from being a simple reproduction of a live performance, as generally it was in the jazz and classical traditions, to a studio creation, a virtual thing in itself. The final song on Sgt. Pepper, beginning with John Lennon's world-weary, "I read the news today, oh boy," ends with a swirling vortex of electronically manipulated sound that suggests the planetary visions of Stockhausen's Hymnen. These Beatles albums significantly altered the notion of what a recording was about, and they proposed that the studio itself, with all its technological powers of transformation, could be a locus of artistic creation representing a new reality, just as the film editing studio had become in the hands of the great film directors. We listened to the George Martin produced albums in a state of astonishment. The sound world was completely new, with its close-miked, uncharacteristic instruments like the scraping, hacking cello of I Am the Walrus, the chirping piccolo trumpet of Penny Lane, or the chugging string quartet behind Eleanor Rigby. The emotional intensity of rock seemed to fly in the face of the studied coolness of serious contemporary music. While I admired the audacity of the 75-year-old Stravinsky suddenly taking up serialism and doing it with what I thought was more imagination and appeal than Webern, most of his late work still struck me as arid and ritualistic, especially when compared with the vital life force of his earlier music, like Le Sacre de Printemps and Petrushka. Requiem Canticles of Stravinsky, which I first heard in a performance at Harvard's Sanders Theater in 1968, felt appropriately solemn and oracular, like those Old Testament stories that the octogenarian composer loved so much. But it was hard to imagine that even as inventive and polymorphous a mind as Stravinsky's could eventually run out of inspiration and require regular daily injections of a severe and rigorous method to give one last stir to the creative juices. I do give just one last a little segment, which is about what composers do, and then open this up for some questions if you have any. What does a composer do? From where do the images and sounds originate, and how are they organized into a coherent statement? There are probably as many answers to these questions as there are individual composers. Anxious graduate students often ask me about the right way to compose, as if there were a correct way to be creative. I tell them that you do whatever you have to do to get the job done, and there is no one proper way to be creative. Some composers are laboriously methodical, painstakingly logical in building a new musical structure. For them, the composing act is as conscious and above board as humanly possible. I guess humanly possible as well. Nothing is left to chance. Others are more like spontaneous improvisers or expressionist painters, trusting implicitly their subconscious instincts. All composers are fundamentally intuitive. There is no such distinction as intuitive versus rational for us. The difference among creative types is in how one responds to those intuitions, whether one fastidiously organizes, compartmentalizes, and schematizes, or whether one is confident enough to let instinct and an animal sense of rightness be the guide and the ultimate judge. The former method can result in a cold, abstract art with strained expressivity, but the latter runs any number of risks, ranging from distended in different formal structures to expressive overindulgence. Beethoven's sketchbooks reveal what for me is the thoroughly individuated creative process in the act. They're exhibit A of how the rational mind collaborates with the irrational feeling function to produce an artistic statement that combines reason with expressivity, producing in the listener a sensation of profoundly unified energies. For Beethoven, that process of discovery could be wonderfully messy and circuitous. Examining his sketchbooks, you see him veering into infertile blind alleys or going in wrong-headed directions, only to grope towards the final authoritative realization of a gesture or musical image. You see the composer struggling to know the potential of his own material. His first versions can be amazingly crude, or if not crude, at least strangely bland. One is astonished that he even bothered to write down some of these ideas. But then you watch the refining process kick in, the unifying of melody with its harmonic underpinning, and you witness the gradual elevation of the material to its ideal status. Composers certainly have the gift of internalizing the gestalt of a piece, of being able mentally to move chunks of material around in musical space, imagining any number of formal arrangements. But this abstract ability can't exist entirely in a vacuum. One needs the stimulation of the tactile contact with sound. That is why so many composers have received their best inspiration improvising with some sort of instrument, be it a piano or a synthesizer, a guitar, or a room full of percussion instruments. We know that Beethoven, even in his period of most advanced deafness, still used the piano as part of a compositional process. And some of you may not have heard, but he actually had I don't know whether it was iron or steel bar that he held in his teeth, and he pressed it against the sounding board, so when he played the piano very loud, he could hear the vibrations through his bones rather than through the eardrum. For me, the most difficult moment is always the beginning of a new piece. Even if I'm lucky enough to have come up with a striking opening idea, the first attempts at developing the material and making coherence often sputter and implode. I like to think that this is because I have yet to define the piece's DNA, and I'm still unaware of what's buried within its strands of information. Often the code of a movement, if not an entire symphony or opera, is encapsulated within the first page or two, albeit in fractal form. Beethoven and Wagner packed an abundance of information into their opening motifs and harmonies. If you think of the opening of Tristan and Isolde, that special chord, or any opening of a Beethoven piece, which is so emphatic and memorable. For me, they're like the DNA code. And they invest them with exceptional potential to generate large and complex expressive structures. But who knows how much effort it costs them to fully realize the potential of what their first ideas contained? Who knows for sure whether after the full work was completed, the composer didn't revisit the opening and tweak it to more perfectly mirror the course of later events? We composers often are at a loss to explain how we made something. Oftentimes, I will be singularly unable to remember the route I took to arrive at some unusually satisfying musical moment. A more methodical composer might probably have a drawer full of schematic flowcharts that would show step by step the evolution of the piece's growth. But I suspect that most composers work in a state of semi-trance, a creative state that is precariously balanced between conscious logical decision-making and the unknowable instinctual workings of the freely associating brain. And I have to say, early in the book I talk about the influence that Jung had on me, reading his theory of types and the understanding of the difference between the rational mind and the irrational the feeling function, the sensation function. I have a deep respect for my own subconscious apparatus and for that part of me that is unknowable. Over the years, I've taught myself to remain open to any unexpected inspiration, virtually to relearn a child's state of mind. I remember sitting in the architect Frank Gehry's studio in Santa Monica while he made pencil sketches of the patterns of scales on a fish. On that particular day, he was obsessed with the way fish scales fit together. Sooner or later, that playful obsession would transform itself into an architectural inspiration. But had Frank Gehry suffered from the usual self-canceling impulses that most mature creative artists eventually acquire, the utter simplicity of his discovery, so pregnant with possibility, would have been nipped in the bud.
Okay, so I have a couple suggestions for operas, and I wonder if you would be interested.
Okay, please, just send them to my publisher.
What about the rise and the fall of the auto industry in the United States? Or secondarily, what about the 8-year term, God help us, of George Bush? W, that is.
You know, I mean, to answer you somewhat seriously, I don't pick my themes, tear them from the headlines, as some critics say. I choose these themes because they're very much at the absolute locus, the nucleus of our experiences as Americans. So Nixon in China is not just simply a news event, but it's all those things that I mentioned, and presidential politics. I mean, we've just been through this. I mean, how many of you 2 weeks ago were saying, I can't stand this any longer? It had invaded our psyches to such a deep place that, people I knew were doing strange things. And so an opera about presidential politics is on the one hand, is very, catches a lot of attention for sure. But on another hand, it's probing something that's very psychically very deep. Same thing with the atomic bomb. I mean, there isn't a more emphatic image of our experience as Americans in the atomic bomb. But I'll take them under consideration. Thank you. Yes.
First off, as a trombone player, thanks so much for writing such fun music. Just have to say that.
Thank you.
I guess my question is pretty broad. What would you say as an American composer is one of the most fundamental things that makes your music distinctly American, or that makes any composer's music that way?
The question is what makes my music and music by my colleagues, contemporary classical composers, American? And I think it's the beat more than anything else. We grow up listening to popular music. I mean, even Aaron Copland grew up listening to jazz. And what made early Copland, which is my favorite Copland, pieces from the 20s, so unique was that he mixed, the rhythmic inventions of Stravinsky and the leanness of Stravinsky with the sort of rowdiness of 20s jazz. And likewise, the minimalists responded very much. When I hear Steve Reich, I hear modern jazz quartet. I hear 50s, vibraphones and that kind of music. And Philip Glass, you can hear his absorption of the sound of rock, along with music from other cultures as well. But certainly in my music, because I'm so deeply wedded to the European tradition, probably more than most other American composers, I'm more of a classical guy, but my music has that sense of pulse, and I think that's what makes it American. Not to mention my name. Yeah.
I wanted to know, given the deplorable state of music education in the country, given the economic conditions that are causing companies to fail, symphonies to cut back or go out of business, recording companies going out of business, if you have some intuition as to what the future of classical music
might be. My God, that sounds depressing.
It is.
You know, the arts are always in peril. I'm not too alarmed because I know that things just change. Yes, I really deeply regret that classical music is not treated seriously in public schools. I mean, when I was a kid, I did, I could take lessons in the private school. Private lessons in the public school, and that's unthinkable now. Part of that is, the American thing. We've just gone through it with this presidential campaign. The governing philosophy in this country is let people keep their money and don't give money to government. And therefore, what you get is, schools where the arts are considered not part of curriculum. Of course, Plato understood and, Aristotle understood that music was every bit as important as everything else. But it's just one of the aggravating anti-intellectual aspects that have been a part of American life since, we were founded as a country. But we get the job done, and we still have the world's most flexible and some of the greatest orchestras. And, we're the country that produced Yo-Yo Ma and Renee Fleming and Emmanuel Ax and Leonard Bernstein, and we'll continue to keep producing people. I agree. I wish the education system could be better, but I'm not suicidal. Thank you very much. Come on.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.